Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Amwha Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Wildberg, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amwha Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, as every single episode, I am your host, Adam Lowther. And today we are talking history. And of course, that means I'm going to have a great guest. So of course, that's what I'm doing. And today we have Dr. Jeremy Pritchard, who is the command historian at 20th Air Force. And this will be one of the episodes in our historical series where we try to capture, you know, the history of what made the nuclear force the nuclear force. And in talking about 20th Air Force, which is our current ICBM force, you know, it's got a long and storied tradition and history that didn't begin with the ICBM. And so we thought we'd, and you know, as we're thinking about replacing Minuteman III with Sentinel, we thought, what better topic to have to discuss, and who better to do it than 20th Air Force's command historian. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Adam. I appreciate being here.
Okay, so 20th Air Force did not start out as the missile force. Tell us about the origins of 20th, and then tell us, you know, its glory days, and of course, its transition to being the ICBM force.
So the official date is, as I tell people, 4-4-44, the four fours, April 4th, 1944. That's the official activation. Its commander was none other than General Henry Hap Arnold, which for most listeners, at least with a lot, much Air Force knowledge, they're familiar with that name because at the time he's the commanding general of the Army Air Forces. So he's already overseeing the entire air component of the Army's effort during World War II. So it begs the question of why General Arnold would, in addition to his Army Air Force command, would want to add on a 20th Air Force portfolio. And it has to do with the weapon system that was being produced just before World War II and then urgently after the U.S. enters the war. And that's the B-29 Superfortress. The B-29 is essentially a next generation bomber from what the B-17 and B-24 crews are flying in World War II. It's got the air pressure cabin, and it can fly farther, it can fly faster, and it can carry a heavier bomb load. When Arnold takes he's very involved and invested in the production and development of the B-29 program. And so much so that when it comes off the line, he wants to try to find a way to kind of manipulate, and that's my word, that might be unfair, but the usage of the B-29. He is weary of, well, let me back up for a second. The B-29 will come in really after most of the fighting in Europe is nearly over, or it's inevitable that the Allies are going to finish the job in Europe, that the B-29s won't really have much of an impact. So he's going to send all B-29s to the Pacific, but he's worried about the command structure out there. You've got Admiral Nimitz, you've got General MacArthur, and then General Stilwell in the China-Burma-India theater. And Arnold is smart enough to know that the moment you start dividing up the aircraft, then those commanders are going to use it as they see fit. And Arnold essentially has this vision of using all B-29s in unison. And that's eventually over the Japanese homeland. And so he will create a numbered air force. Even though he gets a lot of pushback from General Chenault as the 14th Air Force commander, and then General Kinney as the 5th Air Force commander, They're going to tell General Arnold that, hey, you already have numbered air forces. Let's bring those aircraft in here. And Arnold decides to still go forward with the 20th Air Force. It's the last numbered air force activated during World War II. And that's essentially its responsibility. There are going to be two bomber commands that fall under it. The first is the 20th Bomber Command that operates out of the China, Burma, India theater. Very difficult area to operate from. And I don't think Arnold or anyone had I don't think they were naive to think that they would see much success from that theater. But they wanted to, they wanted to demonstrate that, hey, here's an aircraft, here's something that we've been working on for a number of years. We want to get it into the fight. Eventually, when the Marines and the Navy capture the Mariana Islands and secure those for the Allies, that being Guam, Tinian, and Saipan, they're going to transition all B-29 aircraft to those three islands. And that will be the standup of the 21st Bomber Command, which all falls under 20th Air Force, to the point where the 20th Bomber Command in the CBI theater will eventually dissolve and shift all their aircraft over to the Mariana Islands. And from mid-44, when they start these operations, again, it's very slow going, and then capture the Mariana Islands allows the 20th to start operations in November of 1944. And the first commander of the 21st Bomber Command is General Haywood Hansel. He was on General Arnold's staff, and he's going to try to implement the high altitude daylight precision bombing that he was familiar with at the Air Corps Tactical School. Doesn't have a lot of success. Not all of it is his own fault. A lot of it is there are a lot of bugs with the B-29, and there are a lot of different elements in the Pacific theater than a lot of bomber crews and commanders were familiar with in Europe. He has to try to work some of those out. He's not entirely successful. And Arnold, I think, is worried that the war might end, or there may need to be an invasion, a land invasion or a ground invasion, as with in Europe. And that might hinder his efforts at demonstrating the viability of an independent air force. And so Arnold, again, is very invested in the B-29s, 20th Air Force, and then he will move Curtis LeMay into the Mariana Islands in January. And then 2 months later is when the great Tokyo raid, the fire raid starts, and then just absolute devastation from B-29s from then on. The way up to the atomic bombing, and to the point where, you know, a lot of people would have argued that without the atomic bombs, it's possible that the Japanese may have surrendered just from those raids alone. But then that goes into another conversation about another weapon system that people wanted to employ.
Yeah. So it was B-29s bombing the home island. So the war ends, and then what happens?
So the war ends, and there's a lot of cuts, a lot of military cuts. 20th Air Force was kind of the victim of its own success, because it was unique in that instead of responsive to an Air Force command or any of the other commands of the Pacific, it reported directly to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And it's really the first instance that we see of that. That's going to be the precedent for Strategic Air Command. And then a lot of what 20th Air Force is able to demonstrate in the Pacific, in addition to the justification for an independent air force, is what a bomb command can do. And again, so it sets, and this is kind of my argument, it sets the conditions for a Strategic Air Command to take on that responsibility that's going to be much bigger and fuller, to the point where there's really this question of why a 20 Air Force. And there is a 20 Air Force for about 10 years after the end of World War II. I think it was assigned to the Korean War for maybe a week before all of its aircraft were pulled into the Far East Air Forces. And I conclude that a lot of this has to do with the Air Force trying to find its way in its early years. What is it? What is the United States Air Force, and what is the 20th Air Force inside that? In 1955, it will inactivate, and essentially Strategic Air Command again takes on that responsibility on a much greater demand.
And then, so 1955, we stand down, and then when do we stand up as, and tell me about that sort of that process and why, and when do we become the numbered Air Force for the ICBM force?
So in 1991, again, officially reactivated, this was part of, this is essentially the end of the Cold War Air Force. There are a lot bigger movements. Not only will Strategic Air Command eventually inactivate, but so will Tactical Air Command and Military Airlift Command. Those are kind of the prototypical Cold War commands of the Air Force. So there's a big structure going on, and a lot of this is happening under the Chief of Staff, General McPeak. He's very ambitious, and a lot of people even today still have some feelings about what he was trying to do. But essentially, as the Cold War ends, and there's no longer a need for a Strategic Air Command, we're going to kind of build down in some ways, in addition to a lot of the treaties that come out of this time. So they're going to reactivate 20th Air Force, and that will take the ICBM arsenal that had been responsible for SAC since 1959, when the first ones came on.
And so then here we are today, 2024, 20th Air Force. It's had sort of a unique and dual legacy of B-29s and the ICBM force. So let's now go back to the early days of the missile force, because, even outside of 20th Air Force, 20th owns the ICBM force now, but that means that you, as the historian for the command, know the ICBM force really well. So walk us through the early ICBM days and get us up to the deployment of Minuteman III.
Sure. So this was an education for me a couple of years ago. I was sitting in on a briefing, and a commander at the time, asked me, "Hey, how did we do this the first time?" And that was a pretty good indication to me that if my commander is asking me how do we do this, then not very many people do know much about how we did this the very first time. And it turns out it's been over 60 years. Initially, I thought this was going to be an easy, here's how we fielded the ICBMs the very first time. It was actually a very complicated and kind of almost a disastrous scenario based on what I was able to find, to the point where in 1960, it took the vice chief of staff of the Air Force at the time, who was General Curtis LeMay, who not an ICBM guy, he's a manned bomber guy through and through. He comes out to see what the site for the ICBMs looks like, and it's in a pretty pitiful state. And I think that this is surprising, but also not surprising at the same time. I would say it's surprising in that, it's not your typical aircraft. I mean, there's obviously other components that should, gain more merit and attention. But you've never seen anything like that before. The analogy I would come up with is with an aircraft, if whether it's a B-52 or an F-35, you don't have to think about spending as much money and resources, if not more, on the hangars or the places where they're going to be staged, right? All that investment really should be in the aircraft itself. Well, with ICBMs, it's different because there's the missiles, but then there's also the components you need to launch those missiles. And that was really the hangup for quite some time. And how do we get, you know, these launch facilities, how do we get them out into the field? How do we make sure that they're ready for the missiles when they're ready? So there was a lot of challenges at the time. One was they thought that they could do it pretty quickly. They thought, oh, it should be 3 years. Let's put a line in the sand and we'll make sure that's done. That was just kind of wishful thinking, I think, in some ways. There were work stoppages at the time, that labor unions are pretty strong at this point. So that there was this unawareness of what work might be at all these individual sites. And this is like at the time, 21 different sites across the country. You know, today we have 3 ICBM missile wings. Back in the 1960s, when there were 3 different weapon systems and variations or in different versions, there were up to 21. And so that was a really complicated process to try to manage that from a nationwide perspective from the Pentagon.
So are you telling me that the Air Service had trouble digging holes in the ground? That wasn't its natural gift? Digging holes in the ground and burying stuff was not what it was good at? It was only good at aircraft and flying and fighting in the air? Who could have guessed that?
A surprise to everyone, I'm sure.
Okay, sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. And some of the other issues, they were trying to do too many things at the same time. They called it concurrency. Hey, while we're building this, let's also build these other components. Not thinking about the modifications that might need to be made in the process, and that would actually set things back considerably. So you joke, but the Army Corps of Engineers was involved in this process very heavily, but they're also working at 21 different sites, and their structure was such that they didn't have the opportunity to do a lot of crosstalk. And so while someone's working, you know, digging holes in Malmstrom, they may not be talking to the same person who's doing the same thing, you know, in California or in South Dakota. And so that really demonstrated that there wasn't a lot of centralized management over this project.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. Yeah, so let me ask you, so I've read, A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, you know, the story of Benny Shriver and, you know, the creation of the ICBM. If you were going to recommend for the listeners, because, you know, many of the listeners are, you know, avid readers, what would you, I love the book, that book, but maybe there's something that you would say, hey, you know what, as I did the research on this, here's what I think you ought to read. Is there anything you have that you would recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of books. So David Stumpf came out with a Minuteman book a couple of years ago. And it's really, for my money, it's probably the most complete, thorough history of the Minuteman. And he talks a little bit about the Atlas and the Titan development, but really where the Minuteman comes in. It is a technical history. He admits as much. But for a technical history, it actually reads pretty smoothly. So I would recommend that for anyone who just needs just kind of an understanding, or wants, you know, a really in-depth understanding. I would second the Fiery Peace in a Cold War. I think that was, I mean, that's the way you reach a larger audience about an individual. And mostly biographical, whereas David Stumpf's Minuteman III is, I guess it's biographical on a weapon system.
Yeah. I'm audiobooking that book, so it's it's a little dense when you're listening to it on an audiobook.
Sure. Not the abridged version?
No, it's unfortunately no. Okay, so I again interrupted you about some good books. So get us up to, you know, this early period, you know, Atlas is challenging, you know, we finally are going to field our solid fueled ICBM and Minuteman. Walk us through from Minuteman 1 to Minuteman 3.
Sure. And I didn't fully answer your question earlier, how we got to Minuteman. The Atlas and the Titan, and the Titan II would be around for until the 80s. But really the goal all along was to get from liquid fuel to solid fuel. And Minuteman was always the goal. They just knew that it would take longer to get to that point because the technology, the science wasn't quite there as it was for Atlas and Titan. And so those are kind of the placeholders until Minuteman comes online. And as you see the Minuteman units coming online in the mid 60s or early in mid 60s, that's when you also start seeing Atlas and Titan One units deactivating. To get from Minuteman One to Minuteman Two and Minuteman Three, some of the first missile wings actually started off with Minuteman II. They never even had Minuteman I because they were already seeing a lot of the flaws, a lot of the challenges with Minuteman I. So between 1965 and 1974, I believe those are the 9 years, the Air Force and SAC goes through what's called the Minuteman Modernization Program, and that they essentially transition all Minuteman I facilities to either Minuteman II or Minuteman III. And that really just has to do with the timing of when Minuteman III comes on, which is about the late 60s, early 70s. So you have a mixture of some Minuteman II missile wings and then some Minuteman III missile wings. Ultimately, some of those Minuteman II wings will eventually be fall into BRAC and they'll be inactivated. There's some movement of some ICBMs, but that's essentially how you get from the first generation to the second generation. And then, you know, in 1970 is when the first Minuteman III squadron up in Minot comes active, and so that's, you know, we're 54 years into what was expected to be a 10-year lifespan for that missile system, like a lot of the others that came before it.
Yeah, so we had a replacement for Minuteman that, you know, we saw a small number reach the field. Can you talk a little bit about that planned replacement and what happened?
Are you referring to the Peacekeeper or the...
Yeah.
The Peacekeeper. Yeah, so I wasn't aware of this, that there were plans for the Peacekeeper that actually went, officially the MX missile experimental. It came out in the 60s, shortly thereafter. It was intended to replace the Minuteman ICBMs. But then after the Cuban Missile Crisis and a lot of people had a chance to kind of gather their collective breath, there was this desire to maybe we should hold off on further advancement. It's not until the 70s that Peacekeeper gets a relook under the Carter administration. And then eventually during the Reagan administration, that's when it's fielded in 1985. And there's a lot of controversy over how expansive, how it will be fielded. You know, a lot of plans for a mobile Peacekeeper, which there had been plans for a mobile Minuteman that were just, you know, too expensive. And I think the same thing with Peacekeeper. So the compromise was, okay, so we'll field them in a former Minuteman squadron, Minuteman launch facilities, and we'll only do 50 of them. And that's essentially how that replacement worked, while keeping, still some 550 Minuteman twos and 450 Minuteman threes on alert.
Yeah. And then, the Cold War ends. And this is one thing that I was reading, I was doing writing an article on ICBMs not long ago. And I didn't realize just how late the last peacekeepers retired. Can you talk about that a little bit?
A little bit. I think it's 2004, I believe, when it was either 2004 or 2005, I think, when the last one went off on alert. And I think that's also when the 400th Missile Squadron, which was the unit assigned to the peacekeeper ICBM, also inactivated. A good 20 years there. I don't know much more than that. It seems like oftentimes when I ask a question, I think that a lot of that information is still very classified, and they don't want to share too much. But that's about the extent of my knowledge.
And so here we are. We're 54 years since the first deployment of Minuteman III, and we're looking at a future where, if we can get from Northrop Grumman, the missile is on track in terms of its development, but we're having some trouble with, launch facilities and launch control centers and, some of the command post challenges. And, we've got copper wire that's been in the field for 60 years. And this really seems to be where our challenge and additional cost is in the infrastructure. Is there anything that, you think we ought to know about that infrastructure, or in terms of our ability to field Sentinel? Do you see us sort of being able to overcome the challenges, get the LFs refitted, get the LCCs changed out, and just sort of move forward? Because I think if I saw correctly, we expect to have Sentinel till like 2080. Something, another 50-year weapon system. So any sort of lessons that you've learned or that you've been thinking about that might be worth, sharing with our listeners?
So I ended up doing a study kind of on the 1960s, a lot of the challenges that the Air Force encountered. And I didn't necessarily do it as to speak to today's environment, some sort of, slight against, hey, here's what you guys are doing. I'm seeing the same thing. This was merely just someone asked me a question and I went to go do some research and I shared this. The best I can do is demonstrate or, provide this study. Hopefully it can get widespread usage so that way people have at least an understanding of the very first time, because this was, we're coming up on 60 some years when these first ones were installed, and there's not a lot of institutional memory within the Air Force, within the Department of Defense. And so I don't know that talking about a program that was, brought into being in the 1950s and fielded in the 1960s, has a lot of lessons just based on a lot of the technological challenges. The one thing that makes it really difficult for me, because I can't make this comparison, is, in the 1960s, they were digging the holes and they were installing for the very first time. I don't know anything about retrofitting ICBM launch facilities and those components. And so that this is new ground in a lot of ways, and I scratch my head trying to find a non-ICBM another example of, hey, where did we take something and retrofit it in something brand new that was something that was really old and into something that's very technologically mature, with when you think about cyber and stuff like things that weren't on the people's minds 60 years ago. I don't know that I have a good example for that, but if I can at least demonstrate the challenges that people endured in the 60s, then maybe they can start to think about how to overcome some potential challenges in their lane, or at least know that, you know, they're not the only ones that ever had an issue with this.
Yeah. Now it's that time in the show where we like to bring out Bob the Genie. So as I rub my magic lamp and Bob grants three wishes to all guests, now you gotta make wishes about sort of the topics we've discussed. So, you know, no wealth or health or any of that stuff. So Jeremy, what is your first wish?
First wish? Is this a personal wish or just a wish for the field or?
Wish for, you know, we've talked about, you know, the ICBM force. And so as you as the command historian are thinking through what you would want for 20th Air Force, what would you say would be, you know, that number one big wish?
For 20th Air Force. So we just celebrated our 80th anniversary. I don't know that this might be the cop out of the, you know, health and wealth, but it's a fairly rich history, and I would hope to see that it can, you know, last another 80 years. Now, granted that it wasn't active all that time, but even within the years that it was, it's been fairly fairly active, and I would like to see, I would like to hope that there's still a 20th Air Force mission in 80 years. And you know what that looks like, I couldn't say for certain, because I think that, you know, the Air Force will continue to evolve, but I think that would be my one wish. And then I'd still keep some employment too.
Yeah. So, you know, if Sentinel has the life that it's supposed to, you're good for another 50 years. So that gets you close to the 80 that you're looking for. So, you know, let's hope Sentinel comes online without further delay. Okay. So that's right. Wish number one. So wish number two, what would, if you want to bring it down a little more in terms of, you know, I know a lot of command historians and there's always pressures on, you know, history programs. So for wish number two, is there anything sort of more narrowly scoped that you would wish for wish number two?
I will. Yes, I do think that it'd be nice to have a more robust history program. I would speculate, but I think that the Air Force's history program is fairly robust in comparison to the other branches. I think that we're still understaffed, and I know that the other services would feel the same way too. And so I guess if there is a wish, if I could be more of a joint-minded historian, it would be that the military services as a whole would expand the bandwidth for historians, because it often is challenging for historians in the field, often, you know, one deep, to be responsive to an entire Air Force wing or a numbered Air Force or a center. Yeah. And that is, that's almost unsustainable, because, and I'll tell you why, for two reasons. One, we're responsible for capturing the history in real time. I mean, it's a little odd to say that, but, you know, we're kind of the beat reporters. I stole that from someone else, as things are happening. But then we're also expected to be the subject matter experts on what's come before. And that's just a lot of information to try to retain, and a lot of hats to wear at the same time. That's not an easy thing for a historian to do. And some of them, I think, buckle under the pressure of the demand. And so it would be nice to have a more robust history program within the Air Force and within, you know, the Department of Defense as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly a good wish. I'll second that. I'll see what I can do with Bob to make sure that comes to fruition. Now, for a third wish, any big wishes for 20th Air Force?
Big wishes for 20th Air Force. I think I think that they would also like more people. You know, as we look at Sentinel coming on and a lot of the modernization programs, you know, we have a new helicopter coming into 20th Air Force as well. There's a lot of excitement and enthusiasm for these programs. But the reality is that there's still the 20th Air Force airmen that are responsible for today's systems and really yesterday's systems. And so when we talk about, you know, Minuteman III being in the field since 1970, I wish that there were enough maintainers and defenders and operators to sustain that weapon system as it ages rather ungracefully. And it goes back to the, you know, what is the priority for the Department of Defense, and sometimes ICBMs aren't always, I mean, they may be paid lip service to, but they don't necessarily always get the attention or the funding that they're asked to perform for. And so I guess, you know, my third wish would be a more expansive and fuller ICBM enterprise.
Yeah, that's a good one. It is, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, a lot of commands operate sort of at 80 or 85% manning. And so therefore you're always just a little bit short. Mm-hmm. So I certainly understand. Okay. Well, Jeremy, thanks. Unfortunately we're out of time, but thanks for joining us on NucleCast, and thanks for coming to talk about 20th Air Force and the ICBM force.
Adam, it was my pleasure.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode, and we'll see you next time. Interesting conversation, of course. Always, you know, interesting to know where organizations stood up. I mean, did you know that? I mean, some of you probably did. If you're missileers, you probably knew that 20th Air Force originated as a B-29 command. But hey, all interesting, good stuff. Hopefully you enjoyed it.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.